The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Welcome back to another reading from the October 2023 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month is the annual mountain issue, and we're going to start out with Houses of the Holy. Churches have played many roles in Western North Carolina. During the week, they once drew children from miles around to attend school. On Saturdays, they became the community's centers for potlucks and dances, and on Sundays, parishioners still gather to worship, answering the call of the church's bells peal. Written by Jeremy Jones. From my diner booth on a Saturday morning, it's easy to tell the table beside mine is full of people from somewhere else. There are lots of signs from Nebraska sweatshirts and the word eggs sounding like eggs when they order. But the clearest sign comes when one of the men asks for hot sauce and brown sugar for his grits. In this mortal coil, I hold fast to a belief that we can, all of us, find something in common with everyone we meet, no matter our origins or experiences, if we offer only a little time and openness. But I admit to some wavering on this philosophy over breakfast. Then, once everyone has tucked into the food, I overhear Brown Sugar Grits Man telling his companions about his love for old churches. "We stop at every one we see," he says, and in that instant, my worldview is righted. I may have said a little prayer for his tainted breakfast only moments before, but now we are brothers. It's hard to just say what it is about a little community church set off the road, offering nothing remarkable except perhaps a sure-footedness, a steadfastness that will outlive all of us. In my case, it might be a healthy helping of old-time nostalgia. I'm fond of any window into the past that I come across, and an abandoned church on a riverbank throws open its shutters. In one of my favorite passages from James Agee's Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, he and the photographer Walker Evans come across a good enough church on a southern back road. It causes them to slow. As they do, something about the way the light hits the structure overtakes the men. The light so held it that it shocked us with its goodness straight through the body, so that at the same instant we said, "Jesus." In his attempt to capture just what struck them, and then pulled them from the car as if entranced, Agee writes of the strangling strong symmetries of the church. This, he decides, is it, or at least part of it. The beauty of the church is an attempt towards symmetry, and the ultimate failure to reach it, in every distinctly hit nailhead and slightly mislaid board, waits evidence of the human lives who tried their best to make it right. And this trying is more beautiful than perfection. Of course, a rural church a century or more ago wasn't just a church. It might have also been a school, a town hall, a place to share a meal or cut corn or court a young lady. Many old mountain churches were once trains, or at least the bells hanging in their towers once belonged to trains. Today, some of these mountain churches have changed forms again. The original John Creek Methodist Church from 1915 in Caney Fork is now someone's home. Salem Methodist Church in 1875 in the Macon County community of Kalasaja belongs to a community club. When Fontana Dam was completed in 1944, churches in the community like Proctor and Jordan were lost or abandoned. Others appear as if caught in amber. A hike through parts of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park might lead you to a 100-year-old church long since abandoned. You'll find them in Cades Cove and Cataloochee, preserved and beautiful in their modesty. Along the Oconaluftee River, the tower of Smoke Mont Baptist Church from 1912 rises to the treetops of the park near Cherokee. Stepping through the woods and into any of these places is stepping straight into the dusty past. Then there are the churches that have carried on, even as the world around them changed. Brush Creek Baptist, which first organized in 1832 with 17 members and required crossing a swinging bridge to attend, saw the community of Needmore vanish around it when the Little Tennessee River was dammed. Yet it remains active. A striking pair of late 19th century churches perched above the Tuskegee River, Webster Baptist, built in the vernacular Victorian style, and Webster Methodist, the vernacular Gothic, hummed along even as the town of Webster itself slid away and the county seat moved to Silva. Big Ridge Baptist in Glenville was twice rebuilt in its original form after fires, its bell once stolen after being retrieved from the ashes, and now meets in that same revived building as Mountain Bible Church. Distilled or altered or stubborn, these old places wait around the bends of many streams in the Smokies, and whether they're empty or full of song on a Sunday morning, and whether you take your grits with hot sauce or don't take them at all, there's something about these churches that will make you crane your neck. Maybe have you turning around to look a little closer at once was and still is. It's a well-worn cliché that a church is not the building, but the people inside. And yet, as Aggie found on that steamy day in 1936, an old building is something of the people. My grandmother loved to tell of how she hammered nails into Fruitland Methodist Church when she was a girl, saying that she still remembered which ones were hers. Her grandfather started the church after he purchased the land and the lumber to raise it up in 1909. So it's impossible not to imagine my people somewhere within the walls when I pass by, their sweater blood soaked into the floor. Way out in Jackson County, a tiny church on chestnut logs bears the hand-painted name of Danny Hooper's great-grandmother, Catherine. She looked around and said, "The children out here need a school," Danny says. It was around 1806 that Catherine Hooper finally raised the money. And then her husband, Western Hudson Hutt Hooper, built the tiny one-room building to serve as a school and church for the Brasstown community of Caney Fork. Today, the red exterior walls have faded and the pews are empty, but the Hooper family still tends to the building that their ancestors raised up. In every off-center door frame or rock jutting from the foundation of an old church waits someone's great-grandfather or great-great-grandmother, some life that strained and set the eaves just so, In these handmade places, we see not only individual lives, but also communities of people who swung hammers after plowing fields and breaking beans. The men and women who found themselves making a life together along the same stream in a mountain valley had little choice but to come together. So they built brush arbors or piled into houses until one day they decided to pool their money, ride to the sawmill, and see about raising up a church. On a country road, we might see, if only for a glimpse, that an old church wasn't a place built for people, but by people, a place where the framing was itself a kind of worship. Even if the congregation has moved on or the roof sagging, what's left behind is a testimony, asymmetrical and true, that we'll slow down to hear. Moving on to the next article now, The Great Smokies, Arts and Culture. Appalachian folk traditions passed down from our ancestors, a museum dedicated to vintage motorcycles, sweeping photographic landscapes. The Great Smoky Mountains have long been a rich source of creative inspiration. Within the Great Smoky section, peak dedication. In the early 20th century, a Japanese photographer and his writer friend traversed the rugged terrain north of Cherokee, mapping its peaks and valleys, documenting its beauty. In the process, they helped save the land we now know as Great Smoky Mountains National Park. A couple of black and white photos here. Here is a person with one of the, I'm going to say old-fashioned, cameras on a tripod. It's about a foot square and about 6 inches deep, and is mounted right atop the top of the tripod with a little stand out in front, and I think that's where you expanded the outer lens, and there was a bellows attached to it to give you the proper focal length. And then the other picture is a picture taken of a mid-high mountain. It's a dirt path and some low-lying shrubs, and some flowers sticking up, and then it drops off, and we see pine trees in the midsection, and then the mountain peaks in gray in the rear. Of course, the whole picture is gray. It's a black and white or sepia tone picture. It says, born Masara Aizuka in Japan in 1881, George Massa, that's the person who was taking the picture on the opposite page, arrived in Asheville in 1915. There, he fell in love with cameras, photography, and the area's majestic mountain views. His photo of Mount Pisgah, which I just described, appeared on postcards and magazine covers. And I have to say, it's not all that interesting to me, even if it were in color. It's nicely framed because there's some, it looks like oak leaves of some kind hanging down at the top. So you've got something at the top of the picture covering the skies, and there are some clouds. But in the black and white, it just doesn't have the effect that a modern picture, more modern, I should say, picture would in color. There's another picture on the next page of a cover of a postcard, a bunch of Adirondack chairs sitting in front of a stone lodge. And those are really big stones they used to build the lodge. And there's a woman dressed head, neck to ankle in a black dress and a light-colored hat sitting on one of the stones and looking at us. George Massa stood at the peak of Greybeard Mountain and looked east over a vast empire, or rather vast expanse of wilderness. Below sugar maples, red spruces, Fraser firs, and American beeches were among the more than 100 species of native trees blanketing the mountain ranges. Birdsong from chickadees and juncos overlapped with the high-pitched calls of hawks and eagles. Salamanders slithered along banks of creeks below, while foxes and bobcats stealthily tracked prey. Massa had set up his large format camera on a heavy wooden tripod, and waited patiently for just the right light to capture what his close friend Horace Kephart referred to as an Eden still unpeopled and unspoiled. Since meeting in the mid-20s, Kephart and Massa had bonded over shared reverence for the Appalachian Mountains and their timeless, soul-stirring beauty. Kephart was a former librarian turned avid outdoorsman who had published Our Southern Highlanders, a portrait of the Appalachian people and communities that he lived among after abandoning his career and family. Massa had also closed the door on an earlier life, leaving Japan as a young man to seek his fortune in the United States. The two spent hundreds of hours together, mapping and documenting the terrain and topography of their adopted home state. Over time, what began as an avocation grew into a tireless campaign to preserve and protect the region from development and destruction. Together, the friends would become key advocates for the creation of Great Smoky Mountains National Park, an accomplishment neither man lived to see. Not only did they share a passion for protecting the mountains and an appreciation of their importance, says Janet McHugh, co-author of Back of Beyond, a Horace Kephart biography, but their inquisitive natures compelled them to explore and understand the environment. While their names may not be well known, Massa and Kephart's indelible legacy lives on. Hikers along the Appalachian Trail traverse the rhododendron-lined footpaths and clamber up the rock faces that the two men charted, measured, and named. Birders train binoculars on indigo buntings and red-eyed vireos thriving in pristine forests, while gardeners marvel at the more than 1,500 species of flowering plants within the boundaries of Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Anglers pull in rainbow trout and smallmouth bass from access points along the park's some 2,900 miles of streams. And members of the Carolina Mountain Club, of which Massa was a key part in his early history, continue to clear and maintain trails, advocate for forest conservation, and introduce new generations of biophiles to the wonders of the great outdoors. Massa arrived in Asheville in 1915, lured by the promise of a job at the newly opened Grove Park Inn. At the time, Asheville was the state's third largest city, trailing only Charlotte and Wilmington, and increasingly accessible thanks to new roads and train lines. George Vanderbilt's Biltmore Estate, which opened in 1895, had brought Gilded Age glitz to the region, and well-heeled tourists flocked to the cool mountain air, seeking an environment that fostered health and wellness. Working in the laundry room as a valet at the inn, Massa became a popular fixture. He pursued his interest in photography by processing film for guests and taking occasional photos to provide them with souvenirs. As his side job turned full-time, Massa spent more and more of his hours exploring the forests and valleys. Hiking could be challenging, as there were few maps of the Smokies, so he took it upon himself to become an amateur cartographer. After leaving Grove Park, Massa eventually established his own photography studio. Yet, even when working for hire, he would often disappear for days at a time to photograph for personal pleasure. Soon, he became known for capturing never-before-views of the Smokies, and his works were used in guidebooks, on postcards, and in the National Geographic magazine, among other publications. He was even hired by the Asheville Chamber of Commerce as its official photographer. Paul Bonesteel had been fascinated with Massa's work for more than two decades. His 2003 film, The Mystery of George Massa, informed PBS's The National Parks segment by Ken Burns on Massa's role in creating Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Bonestell says that the photographer's quest to capture the Smokies' transcendent beauty became an almost single-minded pursuit. George Massa didn't just love the mountains, Bonestell says. He sacrificed his health and money to preserve and protect them. While Kepert and Massa enjoyed one another's company, there was also an urgency to their partnership. Lumber companies were buying and clear-cutting huge parcels of land in the Smokies. One observer noted with dismay that it looked though much of the land had been skinned, with more than 300,000 acres already stripped clean of vegetation. Massa's photographs, sent to the governors of both North Carolina and Tennessee, and likely shown to John D. Rockefeller Jr., who would donate $5 million via the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Memorial Fund, made a powerful case for preserving the more than 500,000 acres that would define the park. As the park began to take shape, Massa and Kephart helped to establish nomenclature for peaks, streams, and other geographical features in order to create maps and route trails. Hewing closely to local and native references for specific spots, they honored existing names given to its topography by the Cherokee and other inhabitants. In other places, they used humor and expediency as they traversed the rocky Tennessee North Carolina border near Sevier and Swain counties. They labored to reach a steep peak where local mountain guide Charlie Connors' complaints of aching feet inspired Kephart to quip, "I'm going to get this put on government maps for you." Sure enough, Connors' foot woes are forever memorialized at Charlie's Bunyan, a popular vista at the Appalachian Trail, that features one of the few bare rock summits in the Smokies. When the Great Depression hit, Massa lost everything he had. Then, when Kephart died unexpectedly, Massa's grief was profound. He died penniless in 1933, but his adopted family of friends in the Carolina Mountain Club paid for his coffin and later his tombstone. In the 1960s, the club spearheaded efforts to honor him in perpetuity. Today, the small spruce-covered peak of Massa's Knob is adjacent to Mount Kephart, a 6,217-foot mountain close to Clingman's Dome and Mount LeConte, along the Appalachian Trail. Thomas Wolfe was only about 15 years old when George Massa came to town, but the photographer may have made an impact on the budding writer. In Look, Homeward Angel, Wolfe later wrote of a man whose life had been defined by the natural world. The mountains were his masters, Wolfe's narrator says of protagonist Eugene Gant. They rimmed in life. They were the cup of reality, beyond growth, beyond struggle and death. They were his absolute unity in the midst of eternal change. Standing on the peak of Graybeard Mountain today, hikers may not realize how fortunate they are to gaze out over a vista that inspired Massa and Kephart to devote their lives to its preservation. But in the midst of eternal change, watching the clouds roll through the Great Smoky Mountains is a majestic, moving sight that connects us to the men who made it possible. Well, we just have a few minutes left, about five or so. I don't think I'll get through this entire article, but here's a pair of dancing boots, and underneath it says Carolina Barn Dance. Every Saturday night from May to October, in a cavernous hall in Haywood County, cloggers celebrate North Carolina's official state folk dance, and in the process preserve a treasured tradition written by Eddie Huffman. We'll see how far we can get in his article. Two dozen white shoes clack along to the bouncy beat of a country band. Most of the members of the Green Valley Cloggers have white hair, and they're all dressed in matching blue and white outfits. But the feet scampering across the hardwood floor of the stomping ground tonight in Maggie Valley defy the dancers' ages. To get here, those feet scampered over from Canton and Clyde, Candler, and Hendersonville. They come together inside this big barn of a building at the edge of the Smoky Mountains every Saturday night during tourist season, May through October. And not just the members of the clogging team. Between the cloggers' set pieces, amateur dancers stream to the floor to partner dance, line dance, or just lose themselves in the music. They gather here to catch up with old friends and to preserve ancient folk traditions that some of their ancestors brought over from the British Isles. Kyle Edwards has spent most of his life trying to keep those traditions alive. The U.S. Army veteran was born 84 years ago in a house right across Soco Road from where he built the stomping ground in 1981. Mary Sue, his wife of 60 years, has been at his side all the while, and their two children, Burton and Becky, both grew up dancing. My wife and her brothers were jitterbug champions, and my family kindly led the clogging thing, Edward says. We danced at barn lofts, street dances, festivals. Wherever there was a dance, if it was close by, we went to it. A general contractor by trade, Edwards and his brother, an engineer, designed the stomping ground to look like the barns that they danced in as young men. One bluegrass legend, banjo player J.D. Crow, noted its resemblance to a tobacco barn the first time he performed here. He looked up and said, "Man, you could hang a lot of backer up there," Edwards says with a laugh. If you're driving along Maggie Valley's main drag, you can't miss the place. It stands just west of Dale's Wheels through Time Motorcycle Museum and east of Miss Caroline's Wedding Chapel. The inside of the stomping ground feels like a modified high school gym, with indirect lighting illuminating the wooden ceiling, the walls, and the roughly 5,000 square feet of dance floor. Much of the oak and yellow pine used in its construction came from land that Edwards cleared for highway projects. Farm implements hang behind the stage, just beneath the big wooden sign that reads Stompin' Ground, Cloggin', Capital of the Year. Clogging is North Carolina's official state folk dance, representing a mix of regional and historical styles that date back centuries. The roots of clogging are as diverse as the people who settled North Carolina, including Native Americans, African Americans, and immigrants from the British Isles, especially the Scots-Irish. If you're interested in attending a dance at the Stompin' Ground, it's at 3116 Soco Road in Maggie Valley, North Carolina. Their phone number is 828-926-1288. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.